organize the co-mentoring piece today, but I had forgotten about that. And normally to do that, I have a kind of template that I keep track of who's with whom.
Did you say we are supposed to try to stay within our groups?
No. One group is proposing that they huddle together, stay huddled together.
Solidarity in numbers.
As a
strength in numbers.
I do think it would be good to get the co-mentoring groups going, but maybe why don't we do it on Monday? Because by then I think the enrollment in the class will be fully stabilized. I'm not sure if the two people who didn't come today have dropped, which people do after the first. So let's on Monday next week we'll set up the co-mentoring groups. Okay, so the floor is open for general discussion. Why don't we sort of arbitrarily begin with group one? I mean, it seems like it's a privilege of one, but since it's random, who happened to be in group one is an egalitarian in its effects. So group one, who would like to raise an opinion?
Yeah. Okay. So we had several questions, and I'm going to ask the sort of more general question, and then I can really nuance the question. So we kind of agreed that we wanted to know more about what you call scientific realism, and this whole idea of the world existing independently of our thoughts, and being able to explain it in a very scientific language. And we thought we wanted you to say more about this, especially in light of Burwitz's critique, that particular point where he says that we're sort of beings in the world and researchers in the world, and the analytical Marxism doesn't take that into account. And so we were just wondering that how you explain that. And then especially given the fact that this particular position in the Marxist tradition does talk about transformation, right? And so how do you deal with that? From what I remember, and I read Burwitz and your response about 10 years ago, you said something about this is obvious.
Right.
And so we just thought that maybe we'd like a little bit more from that.
Sure.
especially
it doesn't seem like a well-grounded answer.
Well, and can I add a nuance?
Yes.
The nuance being that one of the characteristics, as Eric describes it, of the realist theory of science is that part of it is there's something in how we observe the world that affects what the observations are. Does that occur on the individual level, or does that occur on the level of the individual as a participant in a social group? In other words, is it individual or collective, or is it both? And how do those interchange with one another?
I think the way to proceed here to avoid it being simply a Q&A, even a collectively aggregated one, is for other people who want to comment on this theme. So this will be the theme, our opening theme, is the nature of scientific realism and what's really going on here with respect to my discussion with Burwitz. So anyone else who wants to add either their take on this or add some more specification should do so now, and then I'll give you my ruminations on it.
I would have to think, not to take on the entire question, but regarding your nuance, as with any process that we're talking about, if we want to talk about the micro foundations of natural level systems or whatever the term was, it must occur on an individual level to a certain extent if individuals affect the institutions that we interact with, even if the evidence of these observations and the influence of the outside influence of the world in which we exist appears to occur on an institutional level, that at the same time still being affected by individuals one way or another. So I think at the very least it must occur on an individual level too. On a larger scale than that.
Other thoughts on this?
Yeah. Taking a qualitative research course in addition to this one that sort of boils down this epistemological relationship, which is basically, sorry, I'm using words that are education speak that may not be common in other disciplines. Basically, epistemology is the theory of knowledge, and you know, we mentioned at the beginning the positivist tradition, which is a theory of knowledge where the real world exists outside of the observer, and that we can simply observe it, and it never changes as a result of how we're observing it. And then the other extreme would be subjectivist, where everything is observation, that there's not really a real world, we just construct it as we go. And my understanding of this realist perspective is what in that literature is being called constructivist, where there's actually something going on outside of us, but that we are also part of it, interacting with it at the same time, and that through our observations, I think this is your point, that you know, we change things as we interact with the environment through our observations of the scientific research, so that this, and maybe this is a bad thing because it gets back to the dialectical nature of constructing knowledge, is that you have this thing outside of you that you're also interacting with and trying to study, and the two kind of speak to each other. So, I mean, that's my understanding of it. I don't know whether that's helpful for anyone.
Let me make
just
a few comments on what's been said and try to clarify the scientific rules. The claim that there is a world independent of the observer's thought does not mean that there's a world independent of thought, a social world independent of thought. That is, it is not the case that if all thinking ceases, the social world can continue. The social world is a world of thinking of a particular kind of species created by a particular kind of interaction. Particular kind of creature, which are thinking creatures, and the social world is the way it is, to a very significant extent by virtue of the consciousness and culture and thinking and beliefs and values of the people who are so interacting. So it's not the case that society exists independently of thought. It's a much narrower claim that what is true about the world is independent of what's going on in my head. Whether or not exploitation exists in American capitalism does not depend upon my observer's beliefs about whether or not it exists. I could be wrong. And I could be wrong because of the beliefs I hold. But whether or not I'm right or wrong about that does not depend upon my ideas. It depends upon the way the world is. That's the claim about the independence of the world from our thinking. It's of the thinking of the observer. Now that claim is not challenged by the fact that once we observe the world, we change it. Because the observer is a social creature as well, interacting in the world, and the world is created by our actions and interactions, and one of the kinds of actions we do is observe things, and that certainly changes them as we observe in different ways. They have intervened in various kinds of ways. The fact that we have an understanding of how our role in the world affects what we observe does not change this foundational claim that the world exists independently of our thinking about the world. And therefore, discoveries and corrections are possible. Some kinds of observations that we would care about for social theory may require deep immersion in the contexts which we want to study. It may be that the only way you can get the necessary observations about the world is to be deeply enmeshed in it for certain kinds of problems. Now that seems to me a perfectly reasonable claim. It's context specific. It's not true for all things that we might want to study, but it's certainly true for some things we might want to study. For some kinds of information we might want, the best way is to be a spy on the situation rather than a participant, if we could be. You know, I'd love to be a fly on the wall high-powered discussion among CEOs about how to screw the American people in light of the financial crisis, and see what they're really thinking and how they do it by not being a participant observer, as it were, but by being a secret observer. That might be the best way to get certain kinds of information. It turns out that we can't do it, but that's a pragmatic question, not a kind of fundamental one. My argument with Burlboy about the participant observation versus the armchair observer, the reason I think that this, I don't get what's the big deal here, is I think it depends upon what the questions are and what you're studying. You know, and what kind of data is crucial for what you're studying. There's a young sociologist finishing her PhD at Princeton, who is, I'm hoping we can hire, in Dallas Goffman, whose dissertation is on fugitives from the law in the black community, in which she is interested in the ramifications for the lives of all the people in the social networks in which fugitives live, of the fact that they are being hunted by the cops, you know, they're under surveillance, they're vulnerable to being caught at any time. And given the high percentage of young black men who are fugitives from the law, that's a big deal in certain communities in the United States. Well, how the hell do you get information about that? Well, turns out that she got information about that by living in a black community and neighborhood in Philadelphia for 7 years, after having tutored the kids in this family and being well-trusted and well-meshed deeply in the social fabric of this community. As a friend and mentor and family member, in effect, even though she was also a graduate student at Princeton. And because of that, was able to establish the kind of trust and interactions that would enable her to actually find out about all this stuff. And I don't see any other way you could possibly get, you couldn't get that information from a survey. No. There's no other way to get that information. But I think it's entirely dependent upon the questions you're asking, rather than there being some meta-theoretical methodological rule that says the only way you can get relevant observation for advancing our theoretical ideas is through the discipline observation as opposed to numbers. That's my kind of methodological stand on the Burlboy thing. Now, on the question of scientific realism as a perspective on how you advance knowledge, scientific realist argues that the world exists independently of my thinking about the world. My job is to try to figure out how it works. But to do so, I have to bring to bear concepts and theories. There's no way you can just look at the world. You have to bring your existing state of knowledge to bear, the ideas that you hold to bear on your observations. That may lead you astray. You know, that is, the categories you have in your head, the concepts and theories you're working with, may be such as to make it impossible to see certain things that are crucial to understanding a particular problem that you care about. And depending upon how reflexive you are, how much you're constantly interrogating your own categories, how aware you are of that possibility, you may just blindly quiver along without seeing the anomaly. That's like neoclassical economics. You know, they are so convinced of the adequacy of the categories with which they observe the world that they didn't realize how out of whack those categories were with the possibility of understanding how the world really worked. Paul Krugman has a very nice essay on this in the New York Times Magazine last Sunday, where he argues that neoclassical economists confuse beauty with truth. Basically, they saw that beautiful models, that there's some reason why a beautiful model is more likely to be true than an ugly model. Turns out in social science, probably ugly models are truer than, that is, able to understand how things are actually working in beautiful models. So, I don't, on this constructivist issue, I think this is what Adam was saying, I don't think the polar positions are, either of them are sensible. The view that we entirely construct the world through our categories of thought, that it's entirely in our heads, nor the view that we can observe and generalize from the world without pre-given categories and theories that we bring to bear on our observations. I think the challenge is knowing that we have particular perspectives by virtue of the categories we have, how do we, in spite of that, or through that, gain ever-improving understanding of how the world really works, which means constantly reflecting back upon the nature of the observational distortions or refractions that come from the categories. But this is not some peculiar methodological problem. It's really fundamentally no different from the problem that astronomers have, right? So astronomers look at the universe through, in the old days, through optics that were ground glass curved in a particular way, which had an effect on what they could see and what they couldn't see. And in order to be a good astronomer, you also had to have a reflexive theory about the nature of optics and how that affects what you can see. If you just look through glass lenses without any understanding about how that way of seeing affects what you can and can't see and what it looks like, you would hamper your ability to understand how the celestial bodies work. What you need is, for a theory of astronomy, you also need a theory of optics. Now, a theory of optics has nothing to do with astronomy, right? It's a different domain of science. But you need a theory of optics in order to have a theory of planets, so to speak, because you have to know what the relationship between the two. We need a theory of cognition in order to have a theory of social conflict, because we have to understand how our own cognitive categories affect what we can and can't see.
But, I mean, one way in which astronomy, or earlier on, for something else, you gave the example of Darwinism, would be different from Marxism or Marxist tradition, is that because the revolution part of it, or the revolutionary part of it, is such an important component, right? So, I mean, I guess what I want to know is that, so I perfectly understand that depending on the kind of question you're asking, you pick your method, right? But so the methodology, as a scientist, then the methodology doesn't necessarily have to reflect the revolutionary commitment, right? In which case, that tension between Marxism as a science and between Marxism as a science and Marxism as a revolutionary commitment, you would sort of be on the side of science, right?
Well, when I'm doing science, that is, when I'm trying to produce new knowledge about how the world works, I want to be very careful that I'm not dogmatically adhering to some conclusions because of my belief that they're useful for revolutionary mobilization. That is, I want to constantly reflect upon the nature of the things I believe to be true about the world and be sure that I'm not holding on to certain beliefs about what I think to be true about the world simply because I think they're useful for mobilizing, and not because I think there's good argument and evidence. When I'm trying to produce new knowledge, that is, when I'm engaged in the scientific practice, I want to be sure that I maintain the proper reflexivity and skepticism that makes that practice possible. Now, my claim that there is a tension is that this and I think I overstate the problem or maybe slightly confuse the character. I think there is a problem. I may confuse the character of the problem by globally attaching the word ideology and science, the words ideology and science, to the tension. I think there is a tension, and that may not be the best way to fully capture it. But what I want to avoid, what I feel is a tension, is the way you're cognitive processes work, the way you think, when you're trying to mobilize people and trying to give arguments for action, and the way you think when you're trying to produce new knowledge. Now, if those were identical cognitive processes, if there was no difference between them, then there wouldn't necessarily be a tension. Or if they were different in ways that they didn't operate in cross purposes, there might not be a tension. My claim in that discussion was that I think there is a kind of tension. That tension, the archetype of the tension, so to speak, is between a true believer, a person who feels absolutely confident that they know what to do. You know, they know the strategic line. They know what we have to do to change the world. And they have no uncertainty about it. And certainly they don't express uncertainty. You know, so they want to rally the masses behind that vision of change in which they follow me, I know what I'm doing, have confidence, and try to cultivate the sense of being a true believer. Well, that's the kind of cognitive process which I think operates against scientific practice, where you should never have that degree of certainty and confidence about what you're doing. And if you pretend you do, then you're in some way dishonest because of the, we don't have that level of certainty. So it's really certainty versus ambiguity, skepticism versus true believing around the theories of the world. Now, I am very dogmatic about my values. I consider them secure, firm. I can't imagine a circumstance in which I would abandon them, my basic values. But that's different about my views about how the world works and what are the obstacles to the realization of those values. And the latter is what I feel one needs to be continually skeptical about. I don't mean skeptical in the sense of never saying, well, provisionally, this is what I think. It just means that you never say, I'm absolutely, completely sure about something in terms of how the world works. Does that clarify me some of these? Group number five, say something. Bring something in. We're going to jump out of order just to keep you on your toes.
I'm going to give our question if anybody has any modifications to it in my group. Just shout them out. So, based on the concept of the three nodes of Marxism, you established that the point should be emancipation, the emancipation of all people from exploitation as such, and that basically the most functional and strongest node that Marxism, the Marxist tradition has going for it, is that of class analysis. But in our view, and this is based on what we've seen in the reading so far, accepting that there are things that we haven't read yet that might answer this question, there exists a really gaping hole in class analysis, obviously, in that it doesn't address things directly like gender and race and ethnicity and sexual orientation, things like this. And if the point is to emancipate all people, or emancipate the masses, you know, included in the masses are women and people of non-traditional sexual orientations and, you know, things like this, different ethnicities and races. It seems that what we've been able to gather from the reading is that the most we can find anybody touching on this with an analytical Marxism or our very, very brief introduction to it is the mere acceptance of the fact that Marxism can't, and that class analysis cannot account for everything, which is almost seems revolutionary compared to a previous claims within the Marxist tradition, whereas, you know, class can't, like, you know, the idea that class can account for everything, and it seems, but we are left with the establishment that, okay, well, maybe it is that you can't account for gender inequalities, by example, class that we found that, in your article about the Scandinavian gender inequality within the house. Where are we to go at this point if we have class analysis, which we know doesn't explain everything, but what exists within the Marxist tradition to help us understand these things? Because I don't think just accepting that we can't, you know, figure it all out with one theory is enough to meaningfully address these issues.
Other thoughts on this thing? I just have a lot to say about it. Does anyone else want to add to this particular? Anyone else from group five, first of all, wants to supplement?
Yeah. I think there is a switch between
the idea of classroom space and interrogating inequality to a more broader idea of emancipation in the reading that we did for the last week, the test of social science, which was defined more around a broader understanding of oppression and human flourishing. And that might reveal a sort of transformation in the beauty of analytical Marxism, because when you refer in that book to emancipation, you see class emancipation. So it would be very rooted in the idea of exploitation that gets transformed. Yeah, so
I think that's absolutely right. That in envisioning real utopias, I want to create a broad enough framework that encompasses the full multidimensionality of the problem. And thus, I just talk about human flourishing and emancipation. And I define emancipation in terms of an egalitarian project of equal access of all people to the social and material means to live a flourishing life. And the obstacles to that include many things, many kinds of structures and relations, besides just class relations. So the obstacles to equal access include racism and patriarchy, as well as class, and as well as other things. A crucial obstacle to equal access to the social and material means to live a flourishing life is citizenship. Citizenship in the sense of insider-outsider borders that define who can and cannot live in particular places. Well, that's an obstacle to equal access to the social and material means to live a flourishing life. So there are many obstacles. Now, I think Marxism is a theoretical tradition that has powerfully generated insights around a cluster of fundamental mechanisms involved in this problem, which I loosely summarize under the rubric class analysis, which I feel are fundamental, but that doesn't mean that they are fundamental to every aspect of the problem, but they are fundamental to the problem of human emancipation. They're not just one on a long list, because class analysis centrally concerns the way in which resources and access to the material conditions of life are organized around power relations. Now that's the guts of what class analysis is all about. And that matters in desperately important ways for racial exclusions and domination, for sure. Much of the bite of racial domination comes from its intersection with class. It's not reducible to that. But if the class inequalities connected to race were eliminated, the racial inequalities that would remain that had nothing to do with class would be much more tractable. You know, they would have a wholly different weight in society, and the nature of the interests arrayed against their transformation would be, I would argue, much more fragile, much less, with much weaker capacity to reproduce racial subordination. I would not say that for gender, by the way, because I think gender has a material base inside of intimate relations and biological reproduction in a way that race doesn't. So that the gender problem is different from the race problem in that respect. So my general answer to the question about class and its location within a general emancipatory project is that it is itself a very complicated process. Marxism has identified these mechanisms and has pushed our knowledge of them quite far. Other forms of oppression and exclusion interact with class, and that's a central issue for both class analysis and gender analysis. So feminists need to study the interaction of gender with class, just as class analysts need to study the interaction of class with gender. These are important for both. But the distinctive array of concepts within Marxism are not sufficient to provide an account of all of these mechanisms. And there's no reason to imagine that Marxism as such is the right way to go about elaborating these other mechanisms. That is, that the concepts we have available within Marx may not be rich enough to enable us to understand the psychosexual dimensions of gender oppression. You know, and if you start talking about psychosexual mechanisms, which are what you need to do, you're not talking Marxism anymore. Those are not Marxian concepts. It doesn't mean that they're antithetical to Marxism. You might be able to put them together. It's a bit like if you're in medicine and you are an infectious disease specialist and understand how the toxins produced by certain bacteria kill organisms, and you know, you got your full repertoire of understanding of viruses and bacteria, it doesn't imply that you think that viruses and bacteria explain all illness, that there are genetic degenerative diseases that have nothing whatsoever to do with viruses. And sometimes they interact with viruses. So we know with the, you know that some people will be more disposed to die from flu because of genetic dispositions that affect their immune system than other people. And so there's an interaction between viruses and genes that may be explanatory. But the theory of virology isn't going to tell you what the genetic mechanisms are. Because there's a new theory of genetic dispositions or whatever for that. And I think that's true for social theory as well. Marxism is a theory about a particular cluster of mechanisms. In classical Marxism, sometimes people thought these were of such overwhelming importance for the problem of human oppression that other forms of oppression could really be put on the side. I don't think anybody ever really believed that class was everything, but they came close to sounding like that. One of the advances, I think, of the last 30 years of serious thinking about this, particularly generated by feminism, but not only, is an understanding that there are multiple causal processes with sufficient autonomy between them that are not integrated into some grand functional system totality. That society is not a totality in that sense, of an integrated organic system where all the mechanisms stick together. It's more like an ecology, different subsystems operating, sometimes quite independently. And as emancipatory theorists, we have to grapple with all of this, but it's hard enough to figure out any one piece of it. So there's nothing wrong with specializing and focusing on it. Group number four. Sort of randomly pick numbers here, so answer for all. Somebody from four.
So actually, we brought a surprise. So only the one, someone else from the group can do the second one. And one question that we had is the relationship that your one of your writings and also Sherwin's writings and writing does between the dismantling of the Soviet Union and transformation of the Marxist theory. So the broad question would be, so how do you relate contextual, political, historical change to change in doing science? What's the connection? And then brought up other questions. One of them is the based on that broader question, when you mentioned the revival of Marxism at the beginning of the class, you were mostly referring to the political aspects of Marxism or the theoretical aspect of Marxism, between the interconnection between those, and they relying on that question specifically to Soviet Union, working between the process and the mechanisms that might generate the impact of the change in politics, the change in theory. Especially in your book, you refer to changing the understanding from trying to build a class less society, to building a society with less classness. So how do you sort of come up with that from the theoretically, from the contextual understanding of the dismantling of the state chain? But we also had another question.
Well, given the time constraints, let me just give some reflections on how context affects theory building. Particularly in the social sciences, where there is a strong normative component, which I think is not just in radical Marxists. Social scientists are motivated by moral concerns quite pervasively. That's why they do it. So for many people, ideas develop in the context of argument, who you're fighting against, not just problems you're trying, empirical problems or theoretical problems you're trying to solve. A lot of ideas develop in the context of trying to counter arguments that are being directed against you. That's certainly true in the Marxist tradition. So what happens with the demise of the Soviet Union is it's a tremendous provocation to Marxists. And the debate around the nature of these ideas shifts quite dramatically in the course of the end of the 80s and the 90s. Because of the collapse of a system which was self-defined as embodying Marxian ideas. Now, before, when the Soviet Union was intact and was an ongoing viable social structure in which no one anticipated any easy demise, those of us who were democratic, egalitarian, emancipatory Marxists of the sort that I try to be always found the Soviet Union a kind of embarrassment. You know, it's something we had to argue, but we had to explain away. I had to explain why that did not embody the kinds of principles and arguments that I was arguing for. Why it was an alternative to capitalism, but not a socialist alternative in the sense that I was using the concept of socialism. So my earliest formulations of the notion of statism as an alternative, as another alternative to capitalism, was in response to the need to maintain Marxian ideas in the face of this historic example. But that was important because of the nature of the debates, the fights you had to have with people when you present your ideas and what objections you had to counter. So the ideas emerge, I think, in, this is using the word dialectic in a kind of ordinary sense, not in some fancy sense, the dialectic of arguing against arguments. Now, when I had anticipated falsely, incorrectly it turns out, that the demise of the Soviet Union would be a liberation for Marxism, would make it easier. You know, it would be easier to be a democratic socialist in favor of a radically egalitarian Marxian vision of alternative, and then developing the theoretical scientific tools to understand the world in those terms. I thought it would be easier if we didn't have this social system operating under the banner of Marxism that so violated every principle that the theory was about. That turned out to not be really the case, because what the Soviet Union accomplished from the point of view of theory building was a palpable demonstration that alternatives to capitalism were possible. You know, the Soviet Union showed that there was a possibility. It meant then that Marxists were free to argue, yes, we know that there's a possibility. The problem is it's undemocratic and inegalitarian. And it meant that we could make the argument what we really want is a decentralized, democratically empowered social system in which is anti-capitalism. What does that mean? Let's democratize the Soviet Union. Let's create workers' power at the point of production. Let's create workers' power or people's power in communities. That was a plausible argument, given that it was obvious there was an alternative. It's just what we didn't like. Well, with the elimination of the Soviet Union, the notion that there is no alternative became much more of a problem. The triumphalism of capitalism, that it had won the Cold War, that it was now a global system, that there were no challenges whatsoever on the ground. meant that the critique of capitalism became less anchored in, not the critique in the sense of showing the bad things that it brings, but the critique from the point of view of emancipatory alternative became harder, not easier. In the context of debates, I'm talking about, in the context of discussions, I don't think it became any easier or harder in the actual world. It's always tremendously hard in the actual world. And that's what then led to, in my own work, to thinking through questions of, as we'll see at the end of the semester, what I call interstitial transformations, various other logics of transformation that work inside of existing institutions as a way of rethinking what the transformative problem is. In a context where there's general skepticism, very high levels of skepticism that you face, for there being the possibility of any transformations. I don't know if that answers. Unfortunately, it's after 12. On Monday, I will be next door at 8:30. I came in earlier today, but somebody emailed me and wanted to see the quarter after. So if you want to see me earlier, just come in early. And on Monday, we'll also organize the discussion group, the mentor group. Pass in your names. I will do it in my office this afternoon until the faculty meeting now.